Welcome to Holding the Fire, Indigenous Voices on the Great Unraveling. I am your host, Dar Jamail. How is it possible to attain and maintain perspective on the polycrisis? The march of bad news can feel relentless. Pain, suffering, and death seem to be on display everywhere you look, and there's a palpable sense that conditions will continue to worsen. If I could dream up a person to help me walk through these times, I would conjure an Indigenous person with a degree in environmental anthropology, ideally with honors, maybe from a prestigious institution like Stanford University. The perspective that person could share would be so valuable. Better yet, what if they also had a degree in American Indian education, with distinction, from the University of New Mexico? Fortunately, I did not have to dream up this person, and my friend Stan Rushworth and I had already interviewed her for our book. Here's a taste of Lila June's perspective on our current predicament.
The polycrisis and the convergence of crises and the collapse that we are learning about and experiencing, that crisis happened a long time ago, actually. It's manifesting now, but this crisis has been going on since 1492. Are we reaping what we've sown? Maybe the collapse is fruiting now, but didn't we plant it a long time ago? And why are we so shocked that this is happening? We've been saying this for centuries. It's almost like Creator was giving us 9 lives. It's like we were acting a fool and he was patient and was like, okay, well, let me give you another chance. And we did it again and again and again, kept brutalizing each other, kept brutalizing the earth. And the earth can only take so much. I mean, the fact that she's even lasted this long is incredible. With the amount of brutality and the amount of abuse, she's very resilient. She can actually absorb a lot of abuse. She can handle a lot of insanity, but only to a certain point, you know? And at a certain point, we can't go on like this.
Dr. Lila June Johnston recently received her PhD from the University of Alaska Fairbanks Indigenous Studies Program, with a focus on Indigenous land stewardship, although at the time of our conversation, she had not yet defended her dissertation. She has brilliantly woven her knowledge into her public speaking and multi-genre art, including prayer, hip-hop, poetry, and acoustic music, while inspiring international audiences towards personal, collective, and ecological healing. Even though I'm lucky enough to call her my friend, I still feel fortunate that I got to sit down with her for this interview, where we discussed rebirth, consequences of our actions, reframing collapse, the creation of new paradigms, the Lakota view of selfishness as a mental illness, the gardening of our culture, healing, and ultimately, love. I trust you'll find this conversation as mind and heart opening as I did. Welcome to the podcast.
Hold that spirit.
Well, first of all, Lila June, welcome to the podcast. It's really an honor to have you.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be with you again.
When Stan and I spoke with you for our book, we asked you if you would speak about this time of the converging crises that we are in. And you told us, and I'm going to quote you, "It's understood by Diné people that we've been through the destruction and rebirth of several worlds before this world that we're currently in." And then you went on to discuss each of these cycles that had brought people to an impasse, which is to either evolve, change, or perish. Would you please begin by unpacking that for us here?
Yes, I will happily unpack all of Diné philosophy of the four worlds in 5 minutes. No, I'm just kidding. No, but I will attempt. And I will say my elders would probably be more suited to do this, but I will do my best. Basically, there are four worlds within the Dene historical narrative. And each world had some kind of calamity, some kind of catastrophe that resulted in its death, essentially, but also resulted in a rebirth of a new world. And world might be the wrong term. It's hard to translate from our language to English, but I know that one of them was a flood. You know, a flood came and flooded everything, and we had to begin again, which is incredible to me because stories around the world talk about this flood. It's not just in the Christian narrative with Noah and the Ark and stuff. When I went and traveled to Chile to hang out with the Mapuche, they talk about the flood. If you go to Bali, they talk about the flood. Everyone has a memory of this massive flood, which to me, you know, call me crazy, but I just think that's fascinating. And like, to me, that makes the Dene historical narrative more than just a cute little myth, you know, but that we actually do carry memory in our creation stories, in our cultural stories. Other worlds perished for other reasons that, frankly, I'm not an expert at sharing, and that's a good note for me to learn better what these worlds went through. But I do know that it had different colors. There was the white world, the blue world, the yellow world, and the black world, and then emerging into what we call the glittering world, which is the world we're in now. And the glittering world is the one that is prophesized by many cultures around the world to possibly perish as well. Of course, that's not a given. Everything is open, you know, free game for what humanity and other species on this planet decide to do together. There's no predestined certain doom or certain destiny, but there is consequences if we don't act within the flow of what the creator created, what the holy people created in this world. So if we're acting against the perfect crystalline, you know, DNA, molecular, organic structure that this whole thing was designed to be, then of course we're going to have consequences. So that's the best way I could unpack that, is that Dene people, including many other Native nations, talk about this death of many worlds. There's, you know, with the Azteca folks, the Quinto Sol, the fifth sun, you know, this that we've had El Primero Sol, El Segundo Sol, the first sun, the second sun, you know, talking about a sun being an era, you know, and that we're now in the fifth sun, the fifth era. And so Dene people are not the only nation who has this record of challenges and consequences that the world has faced before.
Then focusing more in now specifically to this continent and specifically to the United States, you've spoken of the colonists coming to Turtle Island, of being a people who had something similar to narcissistic personality disorder, where their self-esteem and their sense of self was so vacant that whenever they saw something greater than themselves, they had to destroy it. And you also have spoken of white supremacy being akin to white insecurity, which is a very similar theme. Would you please talk more about these connections for us?
Yes, you have to have compassion and understanding for Europe at the time. They had just finished 2,000 years of open warfare by the time they started coming, by the time Columbus and that era of folks started coming. And so what you have is folks who are in a dog-eat-dog situation in Europe. They call it the Dark Ages for a reason. You know, it was very, very challenging. You have torture chambers. You have women being raped and persecuted as witches. You know, if someone was deemed a witch, you could do whatever you wanted to her body. You could burn it alive. You could enslave it. You could do whatever you... So the women, of course, being severely abused, which women are the backbone of society, right? So if the women aren't doing well, everything's not doing well. Mm-hmm. You have the Inquisition, you have the British expansion in the Celtic and Gaelic and Cymraeg, the Welsh worlds. You have the Black Death, you know, wiping out a third of Europe overnight. You know, imagine, we can't, COVID was hard, but it wasn't a third of us died, you know. So you have a very traumatized population, which not too far earlier was in a state of pretty interesting harmony with the goddess cultures, with the 17,000-year-old paintings you find in France where they're painting buffalo and horse and ibex and pregnant women, you know, painting, honoring these things on the walls of the caves. You find 40,000-year-old figurines of women made out of clay to honor the sanctity and the fertility of the land. So Europe was in this really harmonious, woman-honoring, goddess-centric culture for a long time. And then, I'm not sure how or when or what, but the Romans and other imperial forces really wrecking shop of this very gorgeous culture, that indigenous European culture that was going on. And everything that they did to native people, they had done to their own people first, right? Like the relocations, right? That they did the Trail of Tears, the Long Walk, everything they did to native people here of putting them on death marches and sending them way over 1,000 miles away somewhere else. That was what the Romans did. Romans were specialists in relocating folks in Europe to and fro. The language prohibition, you know, everything that you see in the boarding schools here where natives were not allowed to speak their language, this also occurred in Europe. Welsh was prohibited. Celtic was prohibited. Gaelic was prohibited. And these languages are also facing extinction. So the women, you know, the way that they would burn the women alive, drown the women alive, that's what they did to native women here. Oh, also conquering in the name of Christ, right? Constantine was doing that in the year 300, in the 300s AD. So 1,000 years before the conquistadors brought the Christ-based conquest to Hispaniola, Mexico, New Mexico, California, and started conquering people in the name of Christ, Constantine was doing that 1,000 years before that. So all of these tactics, which of course Christ would never have approved of, you know, were refined and practiced and then brought over here. So the culture of scarcity as well, you know, which is connected to the culture of insecurity, right? Like I don't know who I am. I've already lost my cult, my indigenous culture to the Romans, to the Inquisition, to the British imperialists, whatever. Then I'm so emasculated, right? Because my sister was just burned alive. My mother was just burned alive. My daughter was just burned alive as a witch. You know, that harms the male ego and the male soul deeply. And I don't believe in emasculation. I don't believe a man can ever lose his masculinity. He is born with it. And it's always Coyote's trick to make him think like, oh, you didn't protect your wife. You didn't protect your daughter. You didn't protect your sister. You did a bad job. You know, she's getting burned at the stake. You know, what kind of protector are you? So that male insecurity, like Trump is a great example, right? Like, I have a feeling that his mother was beaten or his sister was beaten or some sort of the women around him were harmed very badly, which affected his sense of self as a protector, as a man, you know, his very, or maybe he was emasculated in other ways as a child, but he is so obsessively trying to be a man by sleeping with a million women and having all these wives and having all this real estate and having all this money, like he's overcompensating so strongly. And that male overcompensation, that male insecurity is often what arises when you are damaging the women all around him and emasculating him in different ways. So that insecurity and that narcissism, which we know Trump is a narcissist, textbook narcissist, that is always born out of trauma. And so when you bring that narcissism and insecurity and that need to prove yourself, right, and couple that with scarcity of like, if I don't get mine today, I might not have anything tomorrow. And you come upon what we call America, where there's abundance and prolific food systems and bounty, you know, that indigenous peoples have been cultivating for eons because they didn't have the scarcity model. They were in cooperation oftentimes, not always, but a lot of them had come to a place of cooperative symbiotic relationship. So you see this bounty, and instead of saying, oh, this is cool, you say, oh, here's a lot of stuff I can plunder to satisfy my insecure male ego and to also give me a sense of security, because back home, it's like you might not get bread the next day. You know, you might starve the next day. So you better get yours while you can. So I don't know if that helps, but that's sort of the way I conceptualize colonization coming from, and again, rooted in compassion and understanding for the European cultures that were brutalized by various imperial forces for 2,000 years, documented bloodshed all the time, that then came over here. You know, you have to put everything in proper context.
That's very, very helpful, because given everything you just shared, when you look at, for example, the fact that there's even one billionaire, let alone how many there are, and that we're not talking about 1 billion, we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars, that is this insanity, this desperation born of everything that you just described, right? Because how much is enough? Is $1 million not enough? Is $100 million not enough? Is owning half the planet not enough? I mean, where does it end? And that really describes where Western culture has arrived today. Given what you just shared, all of that that has brought it to this point, where does it go from here? You know, when you look at what's happening, we'll just keep it focused on the United States as an example, because it's a very good and extreme example of everything you just described, if not the most. Where do you see this going?
Well, here on Turtle Island, I don't even know what United States of America is. What is that? Oh, is that a thing? I think it's a figment of our imagination. It's a nation state that we've contrived. It doesn't actually exist. It's an idea. Mm-hmm. But that's a side note. Mm-hmm. Where do I see this going? I mean, honestly, I have hope. I have a lot of hope, because when you get burned, you learn. And that's a lot of what I talked about in our interview in the book. Let's look at Europe today, right? Like 2,000 years of open warfare, World War I, World War II. This place is it knows war, right? And then I'm not saying it's perfect by any means, any stretch of the imagination, but look at Europe today. How fascinating that this is a place where a lot of diplomacy is attempting to happen. And I'm not saying it's succeeding. I'm sure there's plenty of criticisms of the UN and all the colonial ways it's perpetuating colonization. But at least can we admit that there is an attempt within Europe to start afresh, right? And to create an attempt at diplomacy, the United Nations being born of war, you know, and again, not perfect. There's a lot of negative aftermath of the United Nations and stuff, but the leaders of renewable energy, the leaders of, they've banned Monsanto, right? Like Monsanto is illegal. They don't have plastic in Europe. Like plastic is illegal. You know, like I went to Starbucks in France and the top was not plastic. It was paper. And I was like, are you kidding me? Was it this easy the whole time to just put a paper top on these things? And the truth is, it was that easy the whole time. And Europe is a leader in all of these sort of enlightened things, you know, organic, like the food is better. And you could argue that the only reason that is because they have all the money and the privilege and they just have a better life. But I think it's deeper than that. I think they've learned a lot from their mistakes, and they're attempting at a peaceable way. And a lot of the support for Native people in Europe is so much stronger than in the United States. There's a coming with a hat in their hands of like, wow, we have done some terrible colonial stuff to the world. And so my point is that in the United States, we're not there yet, obviously, but we are learning we are learning from, and we might learn the hard way. In fact, it's looking like we will, like we are going to collapse and fall on our face in terms of our food system, in terms of our water supply, in terms of breakdown of our government and trust in the government, which we're already seeing being very, very weakened. We're going to experience collapse. But my understanding is that collapse is our friend, because it essentially teaches us, okay, monocrop, that didn't work. Patriarchy, that didn't work. White supremacy, that didn't work. This marriage of capitalism and government doesn't work. And it works for a little while, right? And it has its little upswing, but then it inevitably has its downswing and its collapse. And so I see a lot of hope for this, of us learning by fire. And it might be very ugly, you know, it might be very hard. But if you look in the really zoom out, in the geological time scale, it will refine us and make us better people in the end.
So everything you just shared, these are examples of negative wisdom that when you spoke with Stan and I, you mentioned your elder, Filmer Bluehouse, and the four databases within Dene Fundamental Law. And so negative wisdom and positive wisdom. So it's extremely, it's the, obviously the hardest way to obtain wisdom. But if we come through this, whoever comes through this still has the opportunity to grow and to change and to live in a better way. So would you say that that's accurate?
Yes. And negative wisdom is like touching a hot stove, right? The wisdom isn't negative, mm-hmm. but the way you achieved it was hard, right?
Right.
Positive the wisdom is like, yeah. Oh, that worked. Let's do it again, you know? But the negative mm-hmm. wisdom is some of the most powerful wisdom, because you learn through experience. And that goes, that's from the micro to like people's individual lives, you know, learning how to live your daily life, to the macro of like, how do we as a society function properly? And so that negative wisdom is something that Dene people went through. We collapsed at Chaco Canyon and we fell on our face, and it was intense. You know, we had a caste system there. We had people who were more important and people who were laborers and all that stupidity. We had a hierarchy. And we also, I don't know exactly the details, but I'm pretty sure there wasn't an ecological reciprocity, but rather the resources were used for more power plays. And they say Creator sent us a drought, and Chaco Canyon collapsed, as well as a lot of the surrounding cities here in what we now call the desert, the Southwest United States. And so that collapse essentially gave rise to all these egalitarian societies, all of these societies where every clan was equal. You know, if you look at Dene people today, there is no hierarchy. And that's negative wisdom. You know, and that's ours. That was our journey. That it was hard. We did stuff we regretted. We did terrible things. But you know what? We are different now. And we are people who have in our DNA, you might say, this understanding that equality is so important for not just for humans, but for all life. And that if we live in a proper, kind, respectful way, it will help everything flow better, from social to ecological.
This is a radical reframing of the collapse that we're in and the so-called polycrisis. I mean, there's different ways you hear it referred to, of all these converging crises happening simultaneously. And in some, I think I just usually refer to it as the collapse, as you just did as well. But everything you just shared is a radical reframing of it, because it's so easy to look out and get terrified at the fascistic political crisis simmering barely under the surface. And it's oftentimes erupting on top of it here on Turtle Island. But instead of that, looking at that and completely freaking out, or the climate crisis, I mean, you know, we're literally living in probably what's going to go down as the hottest month ever recorded on the planet so far. And it's so easy to get completely unnerved. But what you just described is, instead of looking at all of this and feeling it's a curse, that this is a gift. And it is a little bit of a leap, right? Understanding that, you know, there is all this negative wisdom going on, and there's so much suffering and death, and it's for sure going to intensify dramatically. So how do we have this, at least in our hearts, this reframing, and how do we carry that going through this collapse, everything that you just shared? Does that question make sense?
Yeah, it totally does. Yeah. I mean, I really appreciate you saying that, because it is a leap and it is radical when you're coming from a standpoint of, well, what about the suffering? What about the species extinction? What about, yeah, the suffering is the best way to put it. This is going to entail. How can you see silver lining in that? How can you see that a positive in that? But I think what I would say is, the polycrisis and the convergence of crises and the collapse that we are learning about and experiencing, that crisis happened a long time ago, actually. It's manifesting now, but this crisis has been going on since 1492.
Right.
For example, like, are we reaping what we've sown? You know, like, maybe the collapse is fruiting now, but didn't we plant it a long time ago?
Mm-hmm.
And why are we so shocked that this is happening? You know,
like, right.
We've been saying this for centuries, you know, like, it's almost like Creator was giving us 9 lives, you know, it's like we were acting a fool, and he was patient and was like, okay, well, let me give you another chance. And we did it again and again and again. Kept brutalizing each other, kept brutalizing the earth. And it's like, the earth can only take so much. I mean, the fact that she's even lasted this long is incredible. With the amount of brutality and the amount of abuse, she's very resilient. She can actually absorb a lot of abuse. She can handle a lot of insanity. But only to a certain point, you know? And at a certain point, we can't go on like this. And so in that sense, to me, the collapse is almost like overdue, you know? Like mm-hmm. The crisis started a long time ago. And if this is what it takes to sit our butts down and be like, no, you cannot do this anymore, period. Find another way. And if you don't, I'm going to force you to. If that's what it takes, then so be it. Because we've been having a ball just being extremely disrespectful to her and to each other, and with no consequences whatsoever. And so in that sense, it's not such a radical reframing at all. It's almost like a no-brainer. Like, what did we expect? You know, extracting her, treating her like a slave, you know, treating the soil like it's just here for our benefit. Putting these animals in factories like they're just meat to be eaten. Like, these are people too. These animals, in an indigenous way of thinking, and even in Europe, if you go back far enough, they saw it too. Just because they don't have 5 fingers and opposable thumbs doesn't mean they're not people. These are people and they deserve respect. So, like, what on earth did we expect besides this collapse? If you punch the very thing that gives you life, again and again and again and again and again, for 500 years, for 1,000 years, for 2,000 years, that thing that gives you life is going to die. So what on earth do we expect? So to me, it's not a radical reframing at all. It's like, this is what we need. If I mean, I would rather us change our ways. Trust me, I would rather us change our ways. And I'm not so innocent myself. You know, I drank a Starbucks yesterday in a plastic cup. I'm so sorry. I did it too. But I wish we would change our ways. And we've been given plenty of chances to do so. We've had plenty of warnings, right? We've had the Hopis tell us. We've had the Haudenosaunee tell us. We've had all these different indigenous prophecies warn us like, hey, this isn't going to work. We've even had Western science tell us, you know, so we've had all these chances and we're not taking them as a society, and the oligarchy is not listening. So if this is what it takes for Rome to be 120 degrees, you know, Rome being the epicenter of this philosophy of conquest, then maybe that's exactly what we need. And I hate to say that, but what on earth else is gonna wake us up?
Right, right. Yeah. We have to hit bottom, and that pain is requisite for that negative wisdom, you know. And I want to read a quote that you shared during the interview with Stan and I, and it's extremely powerful. You told us, it is through the release of fear and the trust in creation, trust in ourselves, trust in our inherent ability to be taken care of by this earth. Only then will we be free. And then you went on to say that until that happens, many of the current solutions being proposed are actually part of the problem. Would you speak a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I don't remember saying that, but I'm glad I did. I'm like learning from my past quote. Self. Yeah. But yeah, I think that the fear, from what I've been told by various elders, I mean, FDR said it, you know, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. Fear is the driver. And you know, a lot of people, they don't like when I say that. They say, well, you know, there's healthy fear. If a boulder is rolling at you, you got to get out of the way. And I understand that, but maybe I'm talking about a different kind of fear than the normal baseline self-preservation stuff. I'm talking about the fear of not having enough. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the fear of not being enough. I'm talking about the fear that drives people to hoard. Mm-hmm. I'm not a Christian, but I do love some of the poetry in the Bible when Jesus says, look at the birds in the sky. They don't store their wheat in barns. They know that the Creator is going to take care of them every day. Look at the lilies in the field. They don't even toil to spin, you know, fabric to clothe themselves, because even in Solomon's finest day, he was never dressed as finely as one of these lilies in the field. So just saying, like, what we are, and that notion that every hair on your head is counted by the Creator, to trust, even in the valleys, they say, you know, to trust in the Creator. Whether you're doing great and everything's great, you know, the Lakota say Creator first in everything. If you're having a bad day, go to Creator. If you're having a great day, give thanks to Creator. Wherever you are, Creator is your friend and is your guide. And so even in the Pali crisis, as strange as it sounds, to trust, which is hard to do. I mean, how are you going to tell someone whose family is dying of starvation, like, oh, just trust in the process, you know? Like, but as insane as that sounds, that's what I'm encouraging us to do. And I don't want anyone to die. I don't want anyone to suffer. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying, let us trust that this teaching moment is our gift. And let us trust that even in these crises, we're going to find new solutions. We're going to find, you know, what do they say? Necessity is the mother of invention. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to have to invent new, quote unquote, paradigms that rely on something different than domination, something different than profit maximization, something different than patriarchy. We're going to have to create new systems. And that's the beauty. And we see it today, like not only creating new systems, but seeking out the counsel of people we've been ignoring for 500 years. Biden just put out an MOU that every agency in the United States government needs to work to integrate traditional ecological knowledge into their systems. I just gave a talk to 135 employees at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Department in Washington, D.C. They're coming to me as a Diné woman and saying, how do we do this? You know, and I'm not the only Indigenous person that they're consulting with. So I guess my point is that release of fear, just trusting, even in this hard time, trusting that there's some nugget of beauty, some nugget of a gift in this process, which includes, you know, Indigenous peoples finally being heard, which includes people being on fire about regenerative leadership and regenerative agriculture and regenerative everything, right? Like, it's like the buzzword, you know, like we owe that new trend in regeneration to the collapse of soil systems. Like, so to trust that some way, somehow, even if I die, you know, Dar, even if I die and I know that it's part of a larger process of learning and that my children will learn and carry on and create something beautiful.
I just want to read that last part of what you said again. Trust in our inherent ability to be taken care of by this earth. Only then will we be free. And I think that leads perfectly into another thing that I'd like to talk with you about is it's so common, especially when I was on book tour for my climate book, to hear people talking about human beings as the problem, as though we're this virus that has infected the planet, and that if we all just would die off, the earth will be better off without us. And you've shared very, very deep knowledge that shows, in fact, the opposite is true. And there's ample proof from Indigenous cultures that shows this. Would you please talk about that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that humanity can be an extreme bane to the ecosystem, and they can also be an extreme gift, depending on the value system that is steering their culture. When the value system is predicated on reciprocity, reverence, respect, responsibility to homeland, ecological egalitarianism, this notion that every species is equal, that we are not above any other creation. When the food system and the land management system is guided by those values, which of course are quite different than the value of profit maximization, the value of resume building, the value of proving yourself and your reputation, you know, those are different values. When it's guided by this other value system of reciprocity, reverence, respect, you're going to have some very interesting food systems grow out of that. So my doctoral research really focused on all these case studies, over a dozen of them, where Indigenous peoples had created extremely sustainable, prolific food systems, and in many cases are still maintaining them today. So for example, the human hand, its presence on the land was what we're now calling regenerative. It is actually better for that human hand to be in that ecosystem than if it was not in there. So The chestnut groves, you know, from Maine to Georgia, which fed not only humans, but a lot of different species. These chestnut groves owed their very life to the careful and precise and gentle management of chestnut groves by human hands. And we know this is true because once they wiped out all the native people in the eastern woodlands, if you will, the chestnuts went almost extinct. The American chestnut is almost extinct. So the burning and the thinning of the forest, burning the forest floor. We call them cool burns. They're very gentle. They're very light. They're not these big Bambi fires that everyone's so afraid of, but fire as a gentle tool in the fall actually helped to space trees, burn away pests, improve soil health, improve water filtration rates, bring in herbivores and grazing animals, which, you know, they do their thing, their contribution to the ecosystem. Because when you burn, you produce nutrient-dense grasslands after the burn. Mm-hmm. When you space those trees, the disease can't grab hold. The trees have better immune systems because they're not all crowded out fighting for limited nutrients and water. And you don't have any issues. But as soon as the colonial culture wiped out native people and stopped burning, these groves collapsed into thickets and a blight took them all out. So anyways, that's one example. Another example is the clam gardens of the Pacific Northwest, where they would actually create these intertidal rock walls that would catch sediment and water whenever the tide would recede. They would actually create these calm pools in the wake of these walls. And so that's how the Pacific Northwest nations actually augmented clam habitat with their bare hands. And again, these clams did not just feed humans. They fed all kinds of birds, minks, different species that were coming around eating the clams. So this is a non-human centric food system that is designed to augment life. Yes, for humans, yes, for human consumption, but also for everything else, the whole food web. So sharing with, how do you share with a crane? You know, how do you share with an otter? How do you practice gardening so that the otters have enough abalone to eat? How do you practice gardening so that the birds have enough pinon seeds to eat? You could go on and on. And so the whole thing is very interesting of how indigenous peoples proliferated these gardens and gardened the land, gardened the earth in bioregional ways. And in ways that Western society has often either ignored or erased, because we're supposed to be primitive, stupid savages, right? We're not smart enough to maintain a chestnut grove from Maine to Georgia. We're not smart enough to maintain an oyster farm in the Chesapeake Bay for 3,000 years straight. We're not smart enough to do alluvial farming. We're not smart enough to manage the Channel Islands so that we could hunt otters for 5,000 years straight. We're not smart enough to augment the kelp forests and in the coastal waters so that the herring have more surface area to spawn. We're not smart enough to let the strongest salmon go first and harvest the last one so that we're actually increasing the strength of the entire salmon population over thousands of years. We're too stupid to do all that, right? But in actuality, indigenous peoples were insanely innovative and ingenious in the ways that they architected abundance and architected entire ecosystems in what I've tried to start calling indigenous regenerative ecosystem design, which happened throughout this continent and in some places is still going on. But to your point, this proves that humans can be a gift. Humans can be a keystone species. Humans can be a positive presence on the land. And that also contradicts this notion that humans are pests. Humans are, you know, misfits of creation. They're a problem and the world would just be better off without them. It's like, no, the world would be better off without this extractivist value system, but not necessarily the humanity as a whole. And we are just hosts for whatever value system our culture carries. And when we're driven by a proper value system, that host can be a regenerative force.
So this really gets down to the quick of all of it, looking at it through the polycrisis lens. The polycrisis is really a crisis of values, that indigenous value systems were stamped out, assaulted, crushed, attempted to be completely erased from the planet by the more extractive, profit, self-centered, negative value system. And so the crisis upon us is, are we going to be able to step out of dominant culture value system and step back into an indigenous value system. And that's really what you're talking about. And or at least that's what I'm hearing in what you just shared. And it's heartening to me that the federal government has reached out to you and brought you out to talk to people about, look, here's the better way. Here's the right way, because what you have been doing has absolutely not worked. And I do really want to talk a lot more. You've already been talking about it some, but if you're willing, I'd like to dive even deeper into the values, because you've talked about reciprocity, trust, transparency, kinship, these extremely important values that have largely been lost or attempted to be erased by the dominant culture. And you shared also, I'm going to read another of your quotes. You said, "I always refer to my elders because I feel like they have the only things worth saying. They talk about how long ago and still today, we also had competition in our societies, but it was a competition of who could be the most humble, who could be the most kind, who could be the most loving, who could be the most generous, and who could be the most courageous, not in an egotistical sense, but in a communal sense." Would you talk more about that as a model for us?
Yes, I think competition might not be the perfect word to describe it, but there was a pressure, a social expectation, and a norm of like, this is how you be. And if you don't act that way, you were kind of seen as, the Lakotas go so far as to say that selfishness was viewed as a mental illness. And when you were hoarding, they would be like, what is this? Like, what's going on here? Is this person okay? Do you need to like put you in the sweat lodge? Like, are you all right?
That's fantastic.
And so I want to briefly tip my hat to the Anishinaabe people, also known as Ojibwe people. They have something similar called the Seven Grandfather Teachings, or the Seven Grandfather Values, if you will. And they are humility, bravery, honesty, wisdom, truth, respect, and love. And of course, these are English terms, but they have their own words in the Anishinaabe language. And so these seven grandfather teachings were what guided the entire society. And they were codified. You know what I mean? Like, these seven teachings were embedded in the songs, in the stories, in the memory, in the way that they would teach the children during certain events. And so when you have these seven grandfather teachings that are just as sacred to them as the United States Constitution is to folks in Washington, D.C., you know, this sacred guiding light that we have all agreed is our philosophy, you know, imagine if society was really like these seven grandfather teachings were really strongly within us, and we were being held to them. What would our world look like? I loved what you said. You know, that's the value system that is giving you hope, that and that the do or die moment is like, can we fix our value system? And that's also what Orrin Lyons has said of the Onondaga Nation. I guess he went on a big quest to figure out, you know, what can we do? What is the solution? And he came out with just a few words, long sentence, and it was value change for survival. And it shows that the people who are doing the culture work, the people who are making the films and the books and the paintings and the music that is really gardening our values, tending that and piquing people's interest about, oh, what if we did this? that work is so important because it's the heart of the culture and it ripples outward. It might seem like a waste of time to publish a song that's all about humility and to do it right in a way that resonates with people. And because what does that do? That doesn't feed a hungry child. That doesn't plant an organic seed that doesn't, you know, bring a waterway back, but it does start to garden the landscape of our inner value system, the invisible world of our human heart, the things we hold sacred, the things we believe are important. You know, if we can garden that, it will ripple outward and it will be the rudder that steers the behavior of people. And that is a very important place to work. So yeah, I liked what you said, how you framed it of like, this is the fulcrum point, you know, of like, is our value system, which sounds boring. I remember growing up, people said value systems when I was a kid, like, well, value system, that sounds boring, like, whatever, let's just get to the good part, right? But I think it actually is extremely important.
Well, because if we don't start there and come from that and let that be our focus, then we are running around on a more surface level. Oh, well, let's just switch over to electric cars, or let's just make these more superficial changes, or try to have a green economy and things like this. And that's not going to actually change anything. The only real change, true change of ourselves, and then therefore our relationship to the planet, is only going to come from living with right values. I mean, all this other stuff almost looks laughable, like people running around with their hair on fire, you know, just, oh, we got to do this, we got to do this, sign this petition, vote for this person. Like, that's almost laughable compared to what you just shared about, well, what are your values? Because this other stuff's just not only completely missing the point, but a gross distraction and tremendous waste of time.
Yeah. I mean, I've thought about that a lot, and I don't claim to have all the answers, but I mean, I think the Tesla is a really good example, or electric vehicles in general, you know, thinking that we would have this technological fix to the climate crisis. But now we're noticing how lucrative lithium is, right? And cobalt that these batteries depend on. And because we haven't rectified our value system from profit maximization to respect and reciprocity and reverence for the earth and for each other, you're having all these lithium mine battles. You know, it doesn't escape me that the Standing Rock Indigenous movement was about stopping a pipeline. And right now in Thacker Pass, there's Indigenous people standing up against a lithium mine and getting arrested. It looks the same. Mm-hmm. And so we thought these electric vehicles, this technological fix, would save us from emissions. Maybe the same could be said about solar panels. I don't know. I have a lot of friends in the solar industry, so I'm trying, you know, but like the ethic of breaking what the creator has made to make something quote unquote better, to take all this sand and silica and turn it into something better, like a solar panel. Is that a change, or is it business as usual? And so I think there's gray area in what you and I are saying. I think that maybe you and I are right, maybe we're wrong, time will tell. But I personally think that yes, unless we fix that value system, maybe the electric vehicle thing would have looked different. You know, maybe it would have been less about producing more and more cool toys and selling them, and more about, okay, in addition to creating electric vehicles, let's also fix our transportation system so that we don't all have to have an electric vehicle. You know, like, mm-hmm. In addition to doing electric vehicles, let's practice localizing our food system so that it doesn't have to travel so far, localizing our entire supply chain, you know? So let's practice being content with being local organisms, you know? That's a tough one, you know, because we're so used to jetting around, myself included, wherever the heck we want. That how do you be grateful for just being a local thing? Mm-hmm. So I think the electric vehicle revolution would have looked different it might have still existed, but it would have been in the context of all these other solutions instead of just this produce as many Teslas as you can, sell as many as you can, sell as many Kia Niros and as many Ford F-150 lightning bolts, you know, whatever. Just produce, be the coolest, newest, coolest toy and buy it and put it in your garage and da da da. Like that spirit wouldn't have taken precedence the way I feel like it is now. So yeah, I think things would have looked different. And I think it just goes to show how important the value system is.
Yeah, perfect. We are coming towards the end of our time. Is there anything else that we haven't discussed? Anything that you're working on or thinking about or feeling about that you want to bring into this conversation?
I think we've talked a lot about societal issues, ecological issues. We've talked about historic civilizations, what they've done right, what they've done wrong. We've been very macro. You know, we're talking about these global issues. And I think what I would also want to share is the micro, you know, is like who you are, whoever you are listening. You are beautiful and you are precious and you are sacred. And I think as much as we need to heal our systems and we need to heal our societies as a whole, we also deserve personal healing. Each of us carries a different story. And not just humans, but even like my dogs outside, my sheep outside, they're all individuals deserving of love. Even the birds and the hummingbirds outside, like they deserve a home. And so like the micro is like, what can we impact in our immediate vicinity? And that gets down to loving the most immediate thing, you might say, which is ourself. And loving those around us. And loving the self is extremely important. To know that you are loved by the creator. Or if you don't believe in creator, you know, you are loved by love itself. You are loved by the earth. You see it when you have a dog or a cat. They love you, you know. They don't care if you just spanked them yesterday or said something mean, which is we probably shouldn't have said or done. They love us unconditionally. And the earth even is trying her best to love us unconditionally. She will still sprout seeds, you know, she will still try her best to feed us as much as we will let her, you know, she loves us. And a lot of the shame we carry, a lot of the pain we carry, trauma, which is very unique and specific to each person. To me, that's something, the last thing I would want to say, you know, is that even though I don't know you, I'm praying for you and holding you in compassion and holding you in admiration of who and what you are. You, even if you do nothing but just sit there, you know, you're worthy of love. We don't have to produce. We don't have to create. We don't have to have all the answers because creator loves us unconditionally, just like he loves all of creation unconditionally. And so I think that's what they call grace, right? Love just because. And if we afford ourselves that grace, that's very similar to what I wrote about trusting and not having fear. Not only trusting in the earth to feed us, but trusting in yourself to be enough and trusting in yourself enough to give yourself that love and trusting that you are everything that the creator designed you to be. You know, I know a lot of people don't believe in higher power. That's okay. But that even if there is no higher power, that love is available to us and why not apply it as a balm for our heart, our soul. A lot of us didn't grow up with a family. A lot of us didn't grow up with someone cheering us on. A lot of us didn't grow up with someone on our side, you know, and that's hard. Even if we were born into it with a silver spoon and we had wealth and this and that, had a roof over our heads and food on our plate, maybe there's still pains we carry from the ways people treated us. And I think that, in addition to healing society and systems and saving the world, you know, everything that you and I think about a lot, also taking the time to save your heart and save your soul through the tool of self-forgiveness, self-love, and self-introspection, and giving yourself a break, you know, and forgiving yourselves for your mistakes and healing any shame we might carry, so that our wings can stretch out again and we can be everything we're born to be. So just a little, you know, thing of saying the outer work is just as important as the inner work. And that all of that starts with saying, I love me with all my flaws and all my antics and all my shenanigans. I love me. And that's a really good place to start.
No, that's beautiful. And it's the antidote, or even maybe a better way to put that is the medicine for what we talked about at the very beginning of talking about the colonists coming over, the traumatized colonists coming over from Europe, where their self-esteem and sense of self being so vacant that they just had to destroy. I mean, everything that you just described is the opposite of that, that if they'd had what you just described, we would not be in this polycrisis. And you just gave us the medicine. So thank you. And thank you for a fabulous conversation, Lila June. It's been a real honor to get to speak with you today.
You too, my dear friend. Thank you for everything. And thanks to everyone who's been listening. And I'm glad I could hopefully help a little bit.
Have you ever felt alone in the shadow of your home? Oh. Have you ever felt like you could fall and slip right through? Oh, 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 oh. It's your heart and hope to die. Look that monster in the eye. Hold on, lightning, don't close your eyes.
Holding the Fire is hosted and produced by me, Dar Jamail, Melody Travers Allison, Asher Miller, and Rob Dietz. Theme music is Hold That Spirit by Ray Zaragoza. Transition music by Lila June Johnston. This is a program of the Post Carbon Institute, and you can learn more about this podcast, along with other information on the Great Unraveling, at resilience.org.
Indigenous people, shine your light, we are equal. Get ready for the glorious comeback of our people, oh yeah. Rise up, all you warriors of love, all you answers to the prayers of our ancestors from above. I can feel it in my heart, can you feel it in your blood? I can hear the seventh fire calling us to wake up, wake all up. All nations rise, rise up, cause now's your time. We don't have to hide anymore, cause now's the time.
That was All Nations Rise by Lila June Johnston. The bird song you are listening to is the rock wren. Thanks for listening to Holding the Fire, Indigenous Voices on the Great Unraveling. Please tune in next week when I'll be speaking with Dilla Fruz Konikboyeva, the inaugural executive director of the Home Planet Fund, the latest tool in the Patagonia philanthropic ecosystem.